Thank you to Opera America for giving me this opportunity. The topic assigned is making change. And I just want to make 3 points today. The first point is that sudden, unpredictable change in our operating environment is unfortunately only illustrated by the pandemic and not confined to it. Complex, non-incremental change is the next normal. This has obvious implications. So the second point is that the way that we plan and manage in the cultural sector in general, and I speak as someone who's been at it for 30 years, is not very well designed for this tumultuous environment. This has obvious implications. The third point is that opera as an art form is now created and performed within a massive range of organizational structures. It's quite a distance from the Met to the UK's Streetwise Opera that Nina Simon referenced last week, but we can identify some of the factors that might increase the prospects for effective institutional adaptation to this changing environment. And I'm going to make a few suggestions. So, point one, there's a lot of it about. That goes without saying, of course. We have 40 million people unemployed. Our cities are on fire, and more than 105,000 people died in the last 2 months from a pandemic that we didn't see coming. And of course, we went into the pandemic having slowly absorbed the scale and severity of the climate crisis and feeling frustrated by an unprecedented and growing level of political, social, and economic polarization, all fueled by an abject failure of governance at national level and apparently encouraged by hostile interventions via social media from Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea. We have technological innovations from artificial intelligence to bioengineering that are transforming the nature of work and its distribution and the character of society itself, probably making some form of national minimum wage inevitable and upending our legal frameworks for contract law and liability for privacy and associated individual rights. Our framework of international law and our international supply chains, on which our reliance is at an historic peak, are threatened by a resurgence of nationalism and the corrosion of international trade and defense agreements, from the European Union to the World Health Organization. Yesterday, apparently, President Trump announced a unilateral plan to ditch G7. We are in a new period of nuclear proliferation. And there is the worst plague of locusts in North Africa and India in 30 years. And at the end of April, the Pentagon officially released 3 videos of unidentified flying objects recorded on infrared cameras. So we definitely live in interesting times. All these dramas, except possibly the UFOs, are interacting in ways that are simply too complex for man or machine to model. And if someone could foresee them, then alas, we lack the systems of governance to address them effectively. Nassim Taleb, the author of The Black Swan, that 2007 book about the growing frequency of unforeseen events with significant impact, fat tails as they're known to statisticians, in contrast to the tails of the curve in normal probability distribution, which are thin and tapering. Taleb has roundly rebuked people who call the pandemic a black swan because so many people did indeed predict it. It's just that our political and civic institutions are unable to muster an appropriate response. The pandemic wasn't a black swan. It was simply a predictable event to which we were unable to create a mitigation strategy in advance of its arrival. Is the current civil unrest in cities throughout America and spreading internationally last night really surprising? If you think so, then listen to one of the most compelling pieces of political oratory I have heard in the last few years. The rap singer Killer Mike of Run the Jewels, last Friday, standing with the mayor of Atlanta, wearing a t-shirt emblazoned with Kill Your Masters. I challenge anyone to watch it and then say, gosh, what a surprise. Would you really be surprised if North Korea undertook a highly provocative nuclear test in the next month? Or if Russia tried to annex more of the Ukraine or Latvia? Were you surprised that China reneged even further on the 1997 Hong Kong handover last week? We're dealing in all these cases, not with black swans, but with what has become known as wicked problems. That is to say, problems that are fiendishly difficult to solve, not necessarily at a technical level, but almost insoluble within current political and social frameworks and values. Other wicked problems can be found in healthcare, hunger, income disparities, obesity, terrorism, and of course, perhaps most urgently today, institutional racism. Let's focus briefly on the pandemic and then use that to underscore the wider point. Here are five known unknowns, to use the Rumsfeldian coinage, that render things somewhat wicked for our sector. First, there is the science itself. Let's just take the pace at which an antiviral can be found, tested, and distributed. Here's Mark Cuban, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, in yesterday's New York Times. Science has advanced. We know more than we did before, and just speaking personally, my expectation is that the science will continue to progress forward with therapies, tests, and vaccines. I'm actually more optimistic about a vaccine coming earlier than others expect. Subtext, we are opening our sports facilities fast. But then here's Ken Fraser, the chief executive of big pharma conglomerate Merck, in last week's Financial Times. A 12 to 18 month timeframe to develop an effective coronavirus vaccine is very aggressive. It's not something I would put out there that I would want to be held Merck to. Vaccines should be tested in very large clinical trials that take several months, if not years, to complete. If you want to make sure that when you put a vaccine into millions, if not billions of people, it's safe. So here we have two high-profile figures with skin in the game making loud, mutually incompatible statements about perhaps the most single front-of-mind issue for the world, when we can put all this behind us. For the lack of an informed consensus about the time to get a vaccine distributed, you could substitute lack of a consensus around any of the following: the length of time for which an infection and recovery may give you immunity, the physical manifestations of the disease, the precise mechanics of social transition and therefore the requisite social distancing, whether there is more than one strain, and at what point herd community immunity kicks in. There's a great article in The Atlantic by Ed Young on the science of all we don't yet know about COVID, and it's long. Then there are the known unknowns of public health policy layered over the science. In Sweden, it's clear, herd immunity. And in Singapore, at the other end of the spectrum, it's clear, test and trace. For the UK and the US, it's far from clear. I've just finished co-writing a short advice note on reopening US art museums that is currently doing the rounds. The lack of a clear national framework is giving rise to multiple paralyzing anomalies. Should you provide masks when you reopen? If you run a museum in Ohio, you're advised not to, because if you provide the mask and an outbreak is subsequently traced to your site, you bear a potential liability that you do not if you simply don't provide a mask. It's a mess. Then there's the unknown. The unknowns of the scale of the economic recession we're facing and its impact on consumer spending, on philanthropy, on international travel, on economic policy. And of course, it's only as we come off cares that the impact will be most fully manifest. Fourth, there are the behavioral unknowns. How will different demographic groups behave when we reopen? Will there be lasting social scarring? How much trust will there be in what we say about the hygienic conditions of our venues? When cultural institutions reopened in South Korea, they've subsequently reclosed on the second wave, and people were asked about whether they were nervous. They uniformly replied, no, if the government says it's okay, it's okay. I think this is unlikely in the US. So the issue of public trust in our institutions is going to be absolutely critical. And fifth, of course, most obviously, just imagine how much easier your life would be if you had confidence that you had a firm calendar date rather than a set of criteria to be met when you could fully reopen. It's unclear when the performing arts may reopen live, and obviously for singers unmasked, in a more than symbolic form of socially distanced performance on video. So there is the as yet unknown impact on the business model, which as they stand are still rooted overwhelmingly in physical infrastructure and live performance. Just how big a cash reserve are you going to need to get to the other side? Those are just some of the more obvious unanswered questions around the pandemic. You know them as well as I do. So I think that now, as of 2:12 Eastern on June 1st, 2020, it's both a reasonable and an important premise that the future is opaque, and that many of the assumptions that we believe we need to be able to make to plan are simply absent. We are temporarily confounded and therefore feel trapped in the present. So on to point two. Opera is an art form that works on long planning horizons, not necessarily quite as long as planners would have us believe, but yeah, up to 5 years out if you're booking famous principal singers who are in demand. So for opera as an art form and as a sector of the creative economy, this is extremely uncomfortable. Just to be clear, our current way of planning in the arts isn't premised on a static environment. We're not that daft. I'd argue that arts managers are highly sensitized to the changing operating environment in which cultural institutions find themselves. There's probably no one listening to this who cannot discuss intelligently any of the following seven topics, all of which are about change. Digital technologies, changing impact on the creative process, on performance capture and on distribution, and the challenges of developing business models around them. Second, long-term impact of demographic change on audience and repertoire. Third, changes in people's appetites for the experiential and what it means for the art form. Fourth, the growing desire for co-creation and for greater agency in the creative process in younger audiences. Fifth, the rise of venture philanthropy and the challenges that the arts have in holding their own in philanthropic marketplace that puts a premium on problem solving. Sixth, the impact of the decline in K-12 arts education on long-term participation. Seventh, changes in how leisure time is structured and planned and sliced and diced, and the challenges this represents for subscription models and for long-form works with set start times. So I'm not saying that these issues have been addressed fully and integrated into our business models and programming strategies, but we have been sitting with them, as the expression goes, for a long time. This has been the stuff of Opera America convenings, of FAT reports, of foundation initiatives, and really for a couple of decades now. Some of their challenging implications, when initially raised, were well outside what's known as the Overton window. But the Overton window has opened considerably. The Overton window is an idea named after a political scientist called Joe Overton, a useful shorthand for the areas of political and organizationally acceptable discourse. In other words, the window of normal discourse. I've seen the Overton window grow in my own work with boards and managements of arts organizations over the past three decades with respect to all this territory. Initially, say early 1990s, as a consultant, I'd get a gig and produce a technical answer, and the client would thank me. We were done until they hit the next problem that between us we might be able to figure out. I relied on my technical skills to earn my living. Then for a long time, let's say 1995 to 2007 or so, the technical solutions were just half the story, the easier half, because the answers were further and further outside the Overton window. Technically, right thing to do gave the client angst or agita because the solutions had unwelcome ramifications for the way of doing business, unpalatable implications for branding, for marketing, for programming, for organizational structure, for the vibe at boardroom meetings. I had to work hard on my rhetorical chops to match my technical ones so that I could persuade the client. But for some time before the pandemic, I really noticed this coming back to consulting in 2012 after a five-year stint running Jazz at Lincoln Center. And spectacularly right now, there has been a porosity and an openness to trying new things. The Overton window is big and wide and open. The questions are now, again, to my mind, more technocratic. They are about what, not why. I believe most institutions are up for radical solutions. They just want to know what radical solutions. But there is a further complexity to all this that I should mention. Unlike the seven issues I mentioned above, what have become, I suppose, the somewhat atrophied standard list of challenges facing the sector, the next generation of challenges, for which the pandemic is, I'm suggesting, only a harbinger, have a different character. They are not long-term secular trends, or at least where they are, they manifest themselves in abrupt, non-incremental ways. Climate change leads to levee breaks in NOLA, or to last week's dam breaks in Michigan, or to the flooding of the theater district in Houston. A discrete event, sudden and out of control. The ubiquity of social media leads to digital swarming around a particular institution or board member. An event, discrete, sudden, and out of control. Pandemics spread quickly. An event, discrete, sudden, and out of control. These require a tactical agility, fast, decisive action in real time and in the spotlight of media and stakeholder attention. We've seen several large cultural institutions misstep and walk it back recently. This is quite different from the context and texture of decision-making required for, say, long-term audience development or deciding your digital strategy. I don't think that the traditional processes of strategic planning work so well in this emerging context. They don't predict the event, and they don't inform the response. The plans are generally set aside quickly. This is because for all the rubric and throat clearing about mission and values in the preamble and the cursory tour d'horizon of the changing environment, they're about institutional goals. And these goals tend to be very concrete, often quite literally so, new education center or whatever. They emphasize specific milestones because these make for good fundraising collateral. They generate quantifiable KPIs. They provide a clear mechanism of accountability to stakeholders. The emphasis of strategic planning is on the planning rather than the strategic. None of this works so well in what has become known as a VUCA environment, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. In fact, an undue attachment to goals can be a liability, and the comfort that it gives stakeholders that you ostensibly know what you're doing and are therefore deserving of support is only partial compensation for the systemic blindness that it can create with respect to a rapidly changing environment. And we probably need to remember that in periods of discontinuous change, mostly it's new organizations, unencumbered by the baggage of the past and ingrained ways of doing things that emerge victorious often. There are obviously companies that evolve, but many are also wiped out. This process is known euphemistically as rationalization. The dynamics are different in the for-profit sector and in the not-for-profit sectors because there's no shareholder class in our world, no unified capital market pushing for efficiencies, mergers, closures. We hang on for longer and sometimes we writhe more publicly. But the convulsive disintermediation, the cutting out of the middleman that has transformed taxis and limo businesses, publishing, music, travel, medical diagnosis is working in where it's working its way towards us. And in these cases, it's usually new players that navigate most easily. Doug McClellan made the point well in his discussion of the impact of new technologies 2 weeks ago. So existing players that have no alternative but to be on their mettle, unwelcome though this news is, the status quo is not an option. And this brings me to my third point, that we probably need some new tools in our toolbox to cope with the sort of ride we may have ahead. As I said at the top of this account, generalizations are dangerous. The situation of a Houston opera or San Francisco or Seattle, they're fundamentally different from, say, Minneapolis's really spicy opera or the Pacific Opera Project, or maybe some organization in between somewhere like Opera Philadelphia. Opera is a broad church artistically and operationally. But I think the general shape of what is likely to work is clear. First, scenario planning. It's important because it forces you to set aside your biases, especially the bias of systemic optimism, and look at alternative futures. The methods are pretty well established, and it's good for intelligence gathering and getting people on the same page. But it's not about choosing and then taking a bet on one of the scenarios, nor is scenario planning about running different financial scenarios. It's about building up different pictures about how the operating environment will play out and then figuring out the impact on your institution and then what you can do about it. As important as scenario planning, I think, is probably working to reduce the fragility of your company, the damage that can be done by exogenous shocks. This is generally called resilience if the shocks don't hurt you too much, and anti-fragility if the shocks actually make you stronger. The greater the chance of exogenous shocks, the greater the importance of thinking this through. We have in our sector tended to ignore the importance of this. We're what's known as fragilistas, and it is above all manifest in one or two metrics. The strength of the balance sheet, especially more liquid assets, and above all, the ratio of fixed to variable costs. We should be working assiduously to change the ratio, remembering that in the very short term, all costs are fixed, and in the very long term, all costs are variable. Third, we should not overlearn the lessons of the last war. The lesson of the war on coronavirus is going to be earned income is a liability because of the very specific impact of COVID-19 on earned income. The next exogenous shock will probably not play out that way. There is no reason why it should. Fourth, in advance of any form of planning, it's good to know and agree collectively what's in column A, as I call it, the essential defining assets, and what's in column B, everything else to which your attachment is contingent and unsentimental. Make sure your mission and your values are in column A, not column B. An agile team with a clear sense of mission and values is probably more effective in this environment than an hierarchical organization marching towards institutional goals that may no longer be helpful or relevant. Last month, I asked seven senior figures in the cultural sector whether by poking around in all this mayhem, they saw any opportunities. It was a tasteless and possibly impertinent question, given what they and you have on your collective plates. But I was surprised at how readily the answers came. Here they are in ascending order of ambition. The first was temper attendance as the principal metric of success. This is especially true of museum leaders who have long complained that using attendance figures as a or the key performance indicator distorts and trivializes. There are great alternatives that have intellectual rigor and general assent. Now it's not possible to use attendance figures as the metric of success and won't be for some time. They are liberated. Second, take a more strategic approach to all programming. There are reasons why programs grow, and some are better than others. Funders often have quite specific concerns or agendas that can exercise a strong gravitational pull, what is often called coercive philanthropy. Education programs, for example, often have to follow the money. It's also easier to say yes than no to enthusiastic, poorly remunerated staff with strong departmental or individual agendas. In a period in which many funders are relaxing restrictive grant conditions and in which there is a new level of resource constraint, focused, well-defined programming strategies with clear goals which they're evaluated routinely and adjusted may have a much stronger rationale. The third was around owning the neighborhood. The positioning of cultural institutions as community anchors alongside educational and health institutions, EDS and MEDS, has been gaining currency over the past decade as the arts community has embraced its role in placemaking. For a period of time, the local area, let's say 3 square miles, is going to be incredibly important. This means a set of agendas for deep engagement in local life. Extend and deepen local partnerships that are currently forming. You know, collusion is illegal in the private sector, but there's a lot of it about. Nonprofits are free to collude, but there's generally less of it. Right now, however, there's an unprecedented level of collegiality between cultural organizations in localities. This offers opportunities for partnership beyond coordinated approaches to reopening protocols, but to revisit the sort of back office sharing that was explored and then largely dropped in the 2008 crisis and its aftermath, and more profoundly for enduring partnerships in areas such as education, public programming, where local and regional cultural coalitions can take on agendas that are beyond the reach of single institutions. And lastly, and I have to credit Richard Armstrong, the director of the Guggenheim, for saying this most eloquently, hone the distinctive contribution of your art form to reimagining society. Arts organizations have an opportunity to make a contribution to civic discourse that is perhaps better aligned to their intrinsic strengths than some that we have promoted heavily in recent years. It's obvious that many of our political and civic institutions have failed in the promotions of the interests of humanity and the planet. That's where I started. We're entering a period where a profound questioning and reformulation of values and priorities is of existential importance, and everyone knows it. We all watched the news last night. Artists and arts organizations, looking back to humanity's highest aspirations and forward in the imaginative processes that are at the core of artistic expression, have a role to play in the framing of that broader debate. In this chaos, there is a mandate. Thank you.